good evening to all of you. I hope that you can all hear me. I'm not sure this microphone is doing very much, but I will speak in loud and clear tones, I hope. So welcome to this session in which we're going to be talking about Enlightenment memories as part of the Night of Ideas co-organized by the LSE and the Institut Français. We're starting from a perspective which is in a sense a question, but a question which is intended to lead us to think about possible consequences. So the question is, what place do memories of the Enlightenment, but also of different historical events, including past conflicts, have in our current sort of intellectual makeup? So this intellectual makeup which we have either inherited from our families or acquired through our educational training, and in particular, for instance, through school curricula. And so in order to speak to this question, we have four participants today. The first person who's going to be speaking is Florence Robine, who is from the Ministry of Education in Paris, where she's currently the Director General for Schools. She is going to be talking about the way in which the French educational system considers itself, in a sense, as a bastion for defending a certain number of Enlightenment ideals, so the way in which it works theoretically, but also some very concrete questions about how to deal with this on a day-to-day basis. And she's currently engaged in an important reform of school curricula, which takes a number of those questions into account. Next, we'll have Léa Huppy, who teaches here at the LSE. She's a professor of political theory. She's giving us another sort of widening of our consideration. She will be addressing the question of progress, what progress means in the 18th century, and whether what the idea of progress means in the 18th century might have something to teach us nowadays. Her most recent book is The Meaning of Partisanship, which she co-authored with Jonathan White. We'll then move on to Rothrad von Kulessa, with whom I will be in dialogue for some of the time. Rothrad von Kulessa is professor of Romanistique. Those of you who are familiar with the German educational system will know that teachers of foreign languages and literature have to have at least two feathers to their cap. So Rothrad teaches both French and Italian. She's also recently been visiting professor at the Université de Lorraine in France. And she will be talking about an anthology we're preparing on the idea of Europe as it is conceived of in the 18th century and the way in which such texts might be made relevant nowadays. And our fourth panelist is David Reynolds from Cambridge, who teaches history, who's well known for his research on the two world wars and on the questions of memory and reconciliation, of which he'll be speaking today. He's also written quite a lot about America before and indeed since Trump's election. So he'll be talking about the narratives of history, and I think that is a particularly topical issue currently. So without further ado, I will hand over to Florence Robine.
Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. So I've been asked to examine the heritage of the Enlightenment, and I'm responding in my capacity as a representative of the French Ministry of Education, because I was so... is to say the number two of this ministry. There is both a unique and privileged position, because as France, I think like Britain was one of the cradles of the Enlightenment. Of course, I'm thinking about our philosophers and also scientists, because I have a scientist background. I'm thinking about Lavoisier, for example, or Émilie du Châtelet, which is quite important woman, I think. And as I really think that the identity of the French education system is partly based on the heritage of the Enlightenment. And I just want to quote something. For example, in the late 18th century, the philosopher Condorcet stated that the French Republic educational mission was, and I quote, to convey the ever-increasing progress of the Enlightenment. And I really think that it's the core of our mission. Today, once more, we can make this statement for ourselves, and I will try to describe what is the place of the spirit of the Enlightenment in French education. And what we can transmit to our students from this period that really shaped our society. Of course, we can transmit knowledge because in France, the age of the Enlightenment is part of the curriculum, followed by our students in history, literature, or philosophy. But I really think that we can transmit much more than this. And French education today is still based on a viewpoint, a way of seeing and constricting the world, a way of acting that has its roots in the idea of critical thinking. And this concept, for me, is at the heart of the Age of Enlightenment. It is what enables us to differentiate opinion from thought, what enables us to enter dialogue with others rather than confrontation, and also that enables us to go beyond intolerance to build a society where we respect others and their opinion. So, in practical terms, how can French education teach, for example, this critical thinking? And how can we enable our children to become free and informed citizens? I think that French education has developed some special features, and I would like to present you three of these, which are, for me, particularly symbolic of the Enlightenment heritage. And as this is an international audience, I won't start with the easiest one. I'll start with what is often the most misunderstood, but so important in French education. I want to take a few words about what we call laïcité, which is usually translated as secularism, but I really don't think that secularism is a good word for it. But so let's get rid of some misunderstandings about laïcité. Laïcité, first, does not mean intolerance, rejection of the other person or their beliefs. On the contrary, for our point of view, laïcité means making the school a neutral, welcoming place, open to all students, whatever their origin or beliefs, if they believe or something, or if they don't believe. Neutrality is needed for our point of view to meet the requirement of freedom of conscience and critical freedom. So this secular neutrality on freedom means that students do not withdraw into their identities. That's a principal point. Instead, we really think that laïcité encourages dialogue and sharing between everyone. The second feature, which I think is quite important in the French education system, and other ones, of course, but is that it helps to build student capacity for critical thinking. That is the art of constructing an argument. It's really important. That means clearly defining a problem, organizing your ideas in a logical way, presenting them according to established, recognized formats. That is what we continually seek to teach. And this art is not only rhetorical, but clearly understood as constructing a rational discourse based on a common culture, which seeks, of course, to convince, but also the purpose is to open the other person and their ideas. This ambition is at the heart of each of the subjects. Of course, I'm thinking about the humanist subject, literature, philosophy, history, and so on, but also, I would say, to scientific subjects. And finally, and this is the third point I would like to highlight, French education gives a full role to culture, to the arts and also to this science, and I really think that is an essential condition for developing awareness and capacity of thought. So, and we'll, of course, end on this point. I really, from my point of view, and I think from also all French people, French education is therefore based on the heritage of Enlightenment. And we are giving particular importance to this heritage because it's needed to help us face the danger that threaten our democratic society. And just a few words about it, if you don't mind. I'm thinking about, of course, the rise of intolerance and the phenomenon of radicalization. I'm also thinking about this new, incredible concept of post-truth. I know that there is another discussion about this concept, and you know certainly about it. I just want to say a few words about it because I was looking on the Oxford Dictionary, which chose this word as the word of the year. Mm-hmm. Incredible. Mm-hmm. What sort of year is it?
Bad.
And it states that this phrase refers to, I quote, circumstances in which objective facts are less influential in shaping public opinion than appeals to emotion and personal belief. So I really think that education has a real role to play in giving our students the capacity to construct free and autonomous thinking based not only and not on opinion but also on reason. And I'm thinking open to others and their ideas. And so I think that the spirit of Enlightenment makes this ambition a reality. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. As a product of the French educational system, of course, I adhere to everything you said. We were initially going to have some questions after and discussion after each person had spoken, but I think looking at the way the time is running, it's probably better if everybody gives their little talk and then we try and have a sort of joint discussion in which we might then be able to take a few questions from the audience. So, Leah, if you wouldn't mind, I think your references to progress will feed quite nicely into what Florence has just said.
Yes, they fit nicely with what Florence just said, and they also, I'm not sure whether they fit with the title of the panel, which is Enlightenment Memories, because I would hope that the idea of progress is not just a memory for us, but that it's, although it might seem to be a memory right now. And so the kind of question that I wanted to raise is, what did the Enlightenment philosophers mean with this progress idea, and why might it be relevant for us? And of course, one way to approach that topic is to think about what we have in common with the Enlightenment. And we have in common several things. One are the kind of circumstances that Enlightenment philosophers faced when they thought about the idea of progress. One of them was religious conflict. And of course, we fear the possibility of religious conflict, but the Enlightenment had it. They had to face existing religious wars. And of course, we fear the idea of authoritarianism rising and taking away people's rights, but the Enlightenment philosophers were fighting authoritarian regimes for the first time and getting rid of despotism in the name of a certain idea of equality that we now hope to have embraced and carried forward in our institutions. And of course, we also fear the rampant inequality that might corrupt our institutions. And again, the Enlightenment was the kind of age where the emergence of inequality due to the rise of capitalism, liberal institutions, liberal economic institutions emerging for the first time, was also becoming prominent. So what might the idea of Enlightenment have to say to us? Well, if we just think about the kinds of circumstances and predicaments that we share with the Enlightenment, we might want to think about why Enlightenment philosophers thought about the idea of progress. And the way to make sense of their question is to think about how we might want to think about morality as taking collective form. We all acknowledge that as individuals we are bound by some duties to our fellow human beings, but we might also want to think about how we can make sense of these duties in the long term. So how might we want to filter them through a set of institutions and practices? And I think that was really what motivated the idea, the Enlightenment idea of progress. It was a secular idea of progress, as it was just said. It was animated by the spirit of critical thinking and fighting of dogmatism and authoritarianism. And it was also animated by a kind of reaction to the religious eschatological discourses of saving human beings from religion and saying, well, no, we can in this world make things better if we embrace the kinds of institutions that allow us to make progress as individuals. And they had, I think, two ways in which they thought about how might we make progress collectively. One was through politics, and so through creating the kinds of institutions that force individuals to subject to them and to respect the laws that they come up with. Say, we embrace the ideal of equality, and then we create laws that reflect this ideal. And so politics becomes a kind of vehicle for progress. And the second way in which they thought about it was progress in the arts, in the sciences, in culture, and in education. And this ties back to what was, again, just said, because it's not enough to coerce people and to ask them to respect the laws. What we also have to do is to build the kinds of habits that make people willingly then obey the laws. So this is, I think, what was really animating the Enlightenment idea of progress. And what was also misunderstood often by critics of the Enlightenment, who accused the Enlightenment of spreading a kind of conception of reason that was intolerant of other people's reasoning, that was intolerant of other forms of culture and practices that were not compliant with the way in which European practices went forward. And so the idea of the Enlightenment had also been Enlightenment progress, have also been attacked, for example, by, say, those who embrace the idea that we live in a kind of postmodern age where there is no way to tell right from wrong, or by the those who think that we live in a kind of post-reason age where reason is the same as emotions and rhetoric and so on and so forth. And by those who would say that the Enlightenment ideal of progress have given rise to narratives of civilizational superiority or attempts to force other people to subject to certain institutions. So I think it's important when one embraces the idea of progress to be aware of the critics of the Enlightenment and to be aware that, yes, there was this other nasty part of the Enlightenment. And yes, it was often the case that reason was instrumentalized by those in power to put it at the service of certain civilizational missions. But what is also important, I think, and this is where I'm going to sort of wrap up and conclude my talk, is to think that it might be possible to make those things that we have learned from the critics of the Enlightenment part of our own way of thinking about progress. And so to think about progress as a kind of learning process through which human beings come up with institutions and practices that are cultural, educational, that allow them to correct the mistakes of the past and to improve on the way in which they relate to each other and on the way in which they build memories that they give to their successors. And if we do think about the Enlightenment idea of progress in those terms, in these kind of more fallibilist terms where we say, well, we learn from our mistakes and we learn from the trials and failures of the past, and we also learn from the way in which the narrative of progress was instrumentalized and put at the service of some ends that we don't disagree, then I think we can preserve this important idea of progress in a more critical way, and we might also be able to put it at the service of a more progressive political project in an age in which the Enlightenment ideal of equality is often challenged and seems to have lost its relevance. So I think I'll just close there.
Thank you very much, Leah, for that enlightening set of comments, I think. Before handing over to Rotrad von Kulessa, I'm just going to talk to you about the background of the project which she's going to mention. One of my hats, as it were, is that I'm president of the French Society for 18th Century Studies. And when the Charlie Hebdo attacks happened, it was just before our annual general meeting. And we arrived at the annual general meeting all completely shell-shocked. The whole of France was completely rocked to its foundations by the series of attacks. And we just sat around saying, this is an attack also on what we believe in, what we've been taught at school, what we work on. Is there anything we can do about it? And the idea we came up with collectively at the time was to compile an anthology of texts on tolerance written in the 18th century. And so we cobbled it together very quickly and to sell it very cheaply through newsagents. i.e. through a circuit which is not the usual book circuit. You know, we weren't interested in talking to our students because we were going to be talking to them anyhow. We were interested in selling the book to people who wouldn't buy it. So this is the little anthology which can go round, if you like. And that was our initial sort of crowdsourced project as far as the texts went. And there was a very lovely follow-on from that Tolerance anthology, which is I was talking to a colleague of mine at Oxford, and I said, who said, oh, it's a fantastic idea. And I said, well, yes, the good thing now would be to have it in lots of different languages. And I have to name her because she did all this extraordinary work. She's called Caroline Warman. Caroline said, we'll translate it. And Caroline crowdsourced 102 students and academics from Oxford to translate the anthology. It was then launched on the first anniversary of the Charlie Hebdo attacks, and both versions are online. This is the English version, which can also go around. Both anthologies are now online, free of charge, on the Open Books website. And we have statistics for the English version. And the English version of Tolerance has been downloaded almost 20,000 times. So that's just to give you an idea of how, you know, sort of our working on the Enlightenment can sometimes translate into concrete actions. And that's what Rothschild is going to be talking about now with another sort of follow-on project.
Thank you, Catriona. So our new anthology project will once again be aimed at a wide readership and a broader public, and will be about the idea of Europe in 18th century. There are general elections scheduled in several European countries this year, which make the project particularly timely. To give just one example of one of the Enlightenment texts that will be quoted and which still makes sense today, is the Plan for Perpetual Peace by Charles Irénée Castel de Saint-Pierre, Projet pour rendre la paix perpétuelle en Europe, published in French in 1713. And the text shows us that the idea of Europe was already being used for one scope, that was to promote peace, thing that we are always trying to do, but that is a little bit forgotten, actually. And so it's a too often neglected aspect in our contemporary discussions about a united Europe. We always think of talking about money and not so about peace. So memory is very short. Castel de Saint-Pierre was a member of French Academy, friend of authors such as Fontenelle, author of political essays, and wrote his project for settling an everlasting peace in Europe in the context of the War of Spanish Succession. The negotiations between belligerents led to the treaties of Utrecht and Rastatt. The first edition of the project was published so in 1713 in Utrecht, and in the text he demonstrates that the equality of power and peace treaties are not sufficient enough to guarantee peace in Europe. The project includes so an arbitration system, a European defense alliance, and the regulation of European commerce based on equity. Saint-Pierre also conceived a kind of European parliament uniting deputies of all 24 member states. He wanted to include some states, not really in the sense of how we conceive it actually. In fact, Saint-Pierre has been inspired by the reflections already expressed in the memoir of the Duke of Sully, counselor of Henri IV, who resumed the ideas of Henri IV about peace in a confederated Europe. Saint-Pierre's essay considers highly topical questions, such as how to deal with neighboring countries, for instance, those of Islamic cultures like Turkey and the Maghreb. So he suggests to associate them with the European Union in order to guarantee a partial integration in Christian Europe of these countries. I think it's also a very interesting idea. So not to exclude, but to try to inclusion of these cultures. The first part of Saint-Pierre's essay was translated in English in 1714 and so was published in London under the already mentioned title, so A Project for Settling an Everlasting Peace in Europe. This essay also inspired other philosophers such as Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who in his judgment about Saint-Pierre's project is a little bit skeptical toward the possibility of realizing this project. According to Rousseau, the sovereigns tend to be too egoistic and too eager to increase their power to realize it. Saint-Pierre also influenced Immanuel Kant, who published an essay on perpetual peace, a philosophical sketch, in 1795, in German it was Zum ewigen Frieden, ein philosophischer Entwurf, also translated in English only 1 year later after the publication in German, so in 1796, entitled Project for Perpetual Peace, a philosophical essay by Immanuel Kant, professor of philosophy at Königsberg. In this essay, Kant extends the idea of perpetual peace in Europe to a universal peace based on liberty, equality, fraternity, and reason. In contrast to Saint-Pierre, the realization of a republican federation of free peoples is not described in detail. His reflections focus more on the abstract level of the philosophy of law and of the idea of cosmopolitanism in a world, on a worldwide level. Other authors, such as Louis-Antoine Caraccioli, in his essay titled L'Europe Française of 1777, emphasizes the aspect of intercultural exchange between Europeans and the existence of a common European identity, even if he conceived this exchange under French supremacy. So we have here already the idea of some kind of transcultural Europe based on common values and on common culture and the progress on culture you talked about. I think it's very important also in the reflections of Voltaire about Europe. We plan so to prepare the anthology in three languages, as the other anthology in French first, then English and German, with translations being carried out by university students under the supervision of their lecturers and professors.
Yes, so this one is a project which is sort of born international already and sort of cooperative. So thank you very much, Rothrad. I'm going to hand over now to David Reynolds, who's going to be talking about a different kind of memory, but which is very much connected to some of the central questions which have already been raised. Some of you may know David's book, The Long Shadow, The Great War in the 20th Century. And in a sense, he's going to be talking about how the not just the Great War, but the two world wars, as we call them, might be remembered and how the memory of these could possibly serve to inform our vision of the future.
Thank you. Well, as you can see, I'm the oddball on this panel. First, I'm male. And I think I do feel very strongly that all panels should have a token male.
So do we.
And secondly, I'm a Brit. And I think in discussions of Europe, there should still be a token Brit. And thirdly, I'm a historian of the 20th century, but actually somebody who believes that you have to understand the longue durée to understand the 20th century. So I feel really very at home in what we've been talking about, but I want to take it from a very different angle. I was thinking first of the whole question of the Enlightenment and the Enlightenment in Britain, on British Isles. And clearly, Britain is an essential part of that, but has, I think, a rather different experience of it. And I suppose, and I'm going to be corrected by all the 18th century historians I'm surrounded by, but it seems to me that in France, the thrust of the Enlightenment has a good deal to do with it being anti-government. It's within the shape of the Ancien Régime, and it's anti-government, and it's also anti-church in terms of the framework of intolerance and restriction that government and church create. In Britain, it seems to me that some of those questions have already been broken in the 17th century because we have had our revolution. We have created our... we chopped off the king's head. I think that was very sensible, actually. But we won't get into that. But we've actually created the idea of a representative government and a constitutional monarchy, at least in embryo. And secondly, although we have a state church, it's a state church that is gradually opening up to provide tolerance for minorities, at least for minority Protestants, non-conformists, as we call them, and more gradually Catholics, Jews, and so on. So there is a greater shape of tolerance already. So the Enlightenment has a different function, I think, in Britain and British Isles compared to France, and we can argue about that later. But I think some of the essential points are very similar. And in the work of people, particularly the Scottish Enlightenment, David Hume, Adam Smith, Francis Hutcheson, and so on, you know, you have the same emphasis on the idea of reason, the importance of liberties, of constitutional government, freedoms of speech, and, of course, the belief in science as a progressive force in society. So there is, I think, a common heritage here. It's slightly different, but it's significant. Let's move on now, particularly with this idea of science and progress, fast forward to the 20th century, or the beginning of the 20th century, the end of the 19th century. Again, exaggerating, simplifying greatly, an increasing belief that science holds the keys to human progress, to a better future, to a more civilized society and civilized world. And then you have 1914. And you have the degradation of the idea of progress. You have the appliance of science to the business of killing in a systematic, rigorous, scientific way. You also have the scientists of Europe who have been a cosmopolitan fraternity, and they are mostly men, a fraternity, a community, shall we say, that now very quickly and very rapidly turn their skills, their trade, their beliefs to their national government's business of killing. So you have a Nobel Prize winner like Fritz Haber in Germany, who is, you know, one of the primary inventors of poison gas and has no problem with it. His wife has a considerable problem. The story is that, in fact, it's one of the reasons why she commits suicide, because he is prostituting his role as a scientist, as an apostle of progress. And I was struck recently, I just came across the Annual Register, which is a record of events in Britain or in the world every year, started by Edmund Burke. It's, in a sense, another part of the Enlightenment project. Talking about what is involved in now the science of war. And there's a slightly tongue-in-cheek element to this, but it explains we're now in the era of trenches. That's not going to win a quick war. The war is going to be a war of attrition, quote-unquote. It was noted that the number of men possessed, and listen to the language and listen to the tone here, the number of men possessed by the Entente powers, Britain, France, Russia, Tsarist Russia, was much greater than the number that the central powers could command, Germany, Austria, Hungary particularly. The war was therefore to be a crude process of sheer killing. And then, assuming that each side killed equally effectively, the Entente would reach victory in an inevitable manner through the working of a simple mathematical law. For the proportionate manpower of the two groups of armies would be constantly altering to the disadvantage of the central empires until at last the odds would become overwhelming and the enemy would collapse. That is the science of attrition, of mass killing, expressed in a beautifully simple mathematical formula. I think probably slightly tongue-in-cheek, but it shows you where we have got to in terms of Enlightenment values and progress and so on. George Kennan, the American historian and diplomat, called the First World War the seminal catastrophe of the 20th century. The seminal catastrophe, the seeds of everything that followed, of the Second World War, the Holocaust, the bomb, which of course is another appliance of science, the atomic bomb, and the Cold War and so on. And so this pattern of two world wars in 20, 25 years is a real question mark to the notion of progress and enlightenment. And what I want to finish is just briefly reminding you of the ways in which those wars have been remembered in different parts of Europe. In France and Germany, where you could say, and again, vast simplification, these two countries or proto-countries have been killing each other on and off for three centuries, there is finally a belated recognition that this isn't actually proving very successful. You've gained a bit of land, you've lost a bit of land, Alsace, Lorraine, you know, whatever it is. And eventually you say, OK, if you can't beat them, join them. If you can't beat them, join them. And that, if you like, is the essence of the whole idea of European integration. The Treaty of Rome in 1957, which we should be commemorating in a few months' time, is, if you like, the alternative to a peace treaty for Western Europe. And it's a way of moving France and Germany on. And if you think of that project, you think of some of the iconic moments of Franco-German reconciliation, the famous picture of Colin Mitterrand at Verdun, that hand in pouring rain, put out on impulse, I think, and, you know, clasped as they sing the national anthems. It's enormously moving, I think, even still. Now, that is a different way of moving on from the wars into a process of reconciliation. British memory, I think, is very different. For us, the two world wars, we still live with the two world wars. We live in them very, very happily. I think that Britain likes to live on its wars. But they're problematic. The First World War is a tragedy, is seen as a tragedy. 750,000 men die. For what purpose? We have to do it all over again. But we know we did it for those continentals. Second World War, we won, sorted it all out, but we did it with the English-speaking peoples, as Churchill puts it, the Americans, the Commonwealth, and so on, not with the Continentals. It's a very different sense of memory and a very different sense of where we go from all that. And then if you think of the other part of Europe, Eastern Europe, very different sense there. The only just beginning to come to terms with these era of wars, because much of Eastern Europe could not talk about history during the Soviet period. And now the history is being unfrozen, if you like, but it's also bringing up the question of double occupation, the term that is often used in the Baltic states, Poland and so on, occupation by Germany and Russia, which was worse, which was more appalling. How do you deal with that? How do you argue about that? How do you begin the process of reconciliation? And how, in a larger sense, do you begin to construct a common sense of European history, shared European history, in a continent where the memories of war are so different and so divisive? And that, I think, is a huge problem, and another part, if you like, of how we can, the challenge of trying to be enlightened in the 21st century. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, David, for raising a certain number of points which I think are absolutely vital to our reflection tonight. One of the things which struck me, listening to your four different takes on the question of what Enlightenment memories might be, is that very often public opinion is shown to be a sort of triumph of the Enlightenment. You know, public opinion when people finally are allowed in absolutist countries to express themselves, to do what they want, and, you know, the fact that we can all have demos or whatever or go on strike is seen as the products of this. And in a sense, post-truth seems to be the absolute failure of the conquest that was public opinion. It's as though it's arrived at the end of its useful life and suddenly something else is replacing it. So I don't know, Leah, if you have any particular reflections on this sort of horrible inversion which seemed to sort of be sketched out implicitly.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is one of the reasons, I guess, for why the classics of political thought were all against democracy, because they thought that democracy is a kind of a form of government that lets anyone have an opinion, regardless of the grounds of that opinion and whether it's an informed opinion or not. And one, in some ways, in this remark that you just made, one can see some of the point of that critique. One, of course, one doesn't want to give up on democracy because democracy is a valuable form of government and is the best catalyst that we have for equality. But, of course, one then also has to pay attention to how one cultivates opinion, and that's why education is so important, and that's why the Enlightenment was right to invest as much on laws and, as you say, expanding rights, so expanding forms of government, giving free speech and so on, as much on laws as on how to become a good citizen. Because if you have good laws but you're not a good citizen, so good laws are not worth very much. And I think that's where this conundrum takes us, where we say, well, we have a lot of free opinion, but we don't actually have informed opinions. And that means that we have good laws that allow us to express our opinions, but maybe we don't have enough good citizens. Mm.
Well, I mean, the word, of course, demos in the classical sense is the crowd, the mob, whatever it is. And that sense of, you know, can you trust the crowd to do it? I was very struck writing the Long Shadow, the famous quotation from Woodrow Wilson when he takes America into war and says, we must make the world safe for democracy. And Stanley Baldwin, who is a pragmatic but not stupid British politician of this period, I mean, with a sense of values, I mean, he says, we have to make democracy safe for the world. You know, this is a dangerous force. And you could argue that much of the 20th century has actually been about the failure to make democracy safe for the world, or at least we have not answered that challenge that you just raised.
Well, certainly recent election results might suggest that.
Yes.
And the shadow which currently hangs over France is not possibly the most reassuring of aspects of possible democracy or possible democratic outcomes. I'd like to turn to Florence Robine now and the question of how Enlightenment values shape the curriculum. And I'm actually going to ask you a question which feeds... it comes from what Leah just said, you know, we need good citizens. Do you think that the educational system's real aim is to shape good citizens? Is that what you would see as the sort of absolute aim of a proper educational system in a democracy?
Yes, that's a real good debate, and I think that's there is different way of thinking about the purpose of democracy. For example, I was 2 days ago in the Education World Forum, which took place in London, and I heard some speeches debating what I think it was a past debate about is it important to have a skills-based curriculum, or do we and I think it's I think I remember it. It was somebody of the English government, but perhaps it's a mistake.
Do we have
to implement a knowledge-based curriculum because skills is completely unuseful? What is really important is to teach knowledge, and afterwards, years after, when the kids have strong knowledge, perhaps you could take a little moment to think about this knowledge. Of course, I'm a little bit exaggerating the speech, but I was really shocked by these words. And in France, too, we have the same debate, really. And it's I think that we didn't really succeed to have a consensus about the fundamental aim of education. But, as you mentioned it, after the terrible attacks we have faced in France, we the consciousness of the necessity of enhancing the citizenship and the common culture and is now well shared in the population. So we try to implement what we called a citizen path, enhancing what we say its citizenship values and thinking about it, and also engagement of students. That means not only theoretical or practical skills, but also what are we thinking about the others? Are we able to debate? Are we able to think about that, to raise empathy? And we try to implement that in each discipline. And it's quite difficult for teachers, for example, to think that they have... they are also in charge of this aspect of education. Mm. But could we say that to face the reality of our society and the division of our society provides a real shock? And I really think that we are we are facing now this debate very strongly.
I mean, there's certainly huge challenges for generations like my generation, which sort of thought there would never be a war again. Yeah. You know, someone whose parents were born during the Second World War. You know, I was convinced that it was a thing of the past. That, you know, we lived in a sort of, not a post-truth, but in a post-war world. Yeah, or that, well, you know, wars might have happened in other places, but not in Europe, where, or at least in Western Europe, where there were sort of secure democracies and this sort of thing. And I think possibly one of the failures of my generation is to have thought that. And I think that's maybe where the question of memory, you know, our memories are not always long enough, and the memories which we need to acquire, in a sense, as second-hand memories, become vital. And I think there, one of the points which was made both by Rothrout and by Lea is that, in a sense, there's not a single narrative, for instance, of tolerance, of reason, or of the Enlightenment as a whole. And we tend, possibly in our educational systems and then also in what we do ourselves, to want to streamline our information and have sort of nice, clear-cut categories. And as a result, we possibly sideline some of the ways in which we could look at things differently. So I'm interested in what Florence is saying about trying to get school pupils to engage with ideas, but also with sort of projecting their sort of feelings, their empathy on the other, in a sense, which I think also ties in quite nicely with the point David made about the way in which different people, different nations, look at the war and the idea that, you know, we won the war, in a sense, which means, you know, that's nice and tidy, which you're saying is the British point of view, you know, so we've won it and so let's get over it, and which means that, you know, we can forget about it, whereas I think it's essential, as you say, to use memory as an instrument to further our aims and our ideals. And Enlightenment has been sort of at the core of this debate, but some of the values that you've mentioned have been have come up several times. And for instance, the confidence in science, which is clearly a product of the Enlightenment, and which then, as you showed, David, was also an instrument of killing in the First World War. But I'm also going to pick up the hot potato which Florence mentioned, which is laïcité or secularism, since that is, I think, probably the one great divider in terms of Enlightenment heritage between the French and the British systems, the Anglo-American vision of things, since the Anglo-American vision is you've all got to be free, and if you want to wear your hijab to teach, well, that's absolutely fine. Whereas France considers that you are then imposing it, in a sense, on other people. So I don't know if, Florence, you would like to say a few more words about...
Well, in such an audience, it's not so easy to explain laïcité in a few words, but I, for example, in the... during the... this campaign on presidential election, it was really fascinating to see how laïcité is central to our debate in our society, and to express there are different forms of laïcité even in France. You can have a very strong laïcité thing that and very militant one, and you have an open mind view of laïcité. That's why, of course, I try to implement in schools. But we really think that laïcité is a protection for everybody, and especially for kids. That means. I don't have here the paper, but the first article of our constitution said that our republic is laic, is a social one, and it's a social republic and a laic republic, and laïcité is the base of our understanding. And the second point, the republic is laic. but the school is laic. Mm. And that's the two pillars of our society. The school, not a university, not the street, not but the school. And the school was laic before the Republic was laic. That is quite important to understand that. Because it was a protection of kids from the very strong impact of Catholic religion at this time, at the time of Enlightenment, and now, and also for the weakness of some families about this way of thinking. And nowadays, the principle is that the civil servants have to be completely neutral in schools. The teachers, for example, they are not allowed to tell what are their beliefs or even their political opinions. It's completely forbidden. They have to be neutral. Is it really possible? Of course, we know that it is not completely possible. And you know that better than me, I think, because you are involved in political science, and I know that, of course. But also it's completely linked also to the development of critical thinking and rationality and so on, and the art of debate and what I try to tell. So I think it's really strong, but it's quite difficult nowadays in some part of our country. Well...
Well, certainly anything which can encourage critical debate and the shaping of a critical mind in the young is something which should be treated favourably. And I think probably the English system estimates that if you are confronted with different things, then you have to sort of make up your mind.
Yeah, that's true. I really want to say that teachers and all the educational team has to be neutral, but not the children. It's completely different. So you do not have the possibility to express very widely what you are, what your beliefs of wearing a cross or having the hijab and so on at school. But it's completely possible to express your opinion, political for a kid or religious one. But the teacher has to put it in a wide
context.
Point of view, yeah. And a wide context. That's a problem. Yeah.
Thank you.
So it's quite difficult to explain in a few words, even and in English, because my English is not so fluent.
You've been doing absolutely brilliantly. We might take one or two very quick questions from the audience, if there is one.
I can pass you the microphone, maybe.
Yeah. Thank you. I found it interesting, Florence, you mentioned French education system now concerned with empathy and those moral issues. I was just wondering whether any of you, to go back to the 17th century, I was thinking of Spinoza in 17th century Holland, who in many ways is a founder of Enlightenment thought, and I've still got to study Spinoza seriously, but one thing I think he is saying is that we have to use our reason to understand our emotions. We have to understand that these passions which can control us and are very dangerous, especially in politics, have to be understood through self-knowledge and self-reflection. In many ways, he was a precursor of Freud. Do you think that maybe this is what we need in our education? We need self-understanding, to cultivate the intellect. Critical thinking, I agree with you, is absolutely central, but don't we need to go beyond the intellect?
Thank you. It sounds like it's a question almost for a psychologist, and not just for somebody who runs the Ministry for Education.
Why don't we take some more questions, maybe? It's an interesting comment, I think.
Yes, I think it's a very interesting comment. And it's good to have Spinoza brought up, who, as you rightly put it, has developed a number of ideas which were then taken up by the Enlightenment philosophers, and partly through his experience of being part of a minority in Holland.
Just in two words, I really think that you're right, of course, and that's why we try to do, for example, in enhancing social skills, soft skills, and so on, and also collective activity, understanding each other, and be engaged even in social activities in your country, in your village, for example, I don't know if you can say that in English. Intergenerational links. We really think that it is quite important, and it's completely necessary. It's not possible to have only a theoretical or intellectual education, that's why I really think that you can't have only a knowledge-based curriculum. So it's so important to try to understand how you have to manage your own life, how you have to react and to interact with other people. We notice actually that there is so difficult problems between the students, for example, like, comment dit, du harcèlement?
Bullying.
Okay, that's where the word she said. and also, for example, in the, because we are developing inclusive school with the disabled people or autistic kids and so on. So you have really to understand each other, even if the person in face of you is so different, of course, of ethnic difference and so on. But not only that.
Thank you. It's great to have a policymaker in the room with us. So I see there's one other question, which I think might have to be the last one we take.
When I was brought up as a child, it was against the background that Europe was the continent, and you were all continentals. And then, by the time I became an adult, we were all part of Europe. And now we've voted to leave Europe. And I'm wondering what the panel think about how they may impact on the Enlightenment narrative as Britain pulls away with its own peculiar history and traditions.
Thank you. So that's confused of Tunbridge Wells, is it? Okay, so where are we in Europe, in a sense? Lead? Sorry?
Yeah, either. So I mean, I like to think this is a positive spin on a story that has depressed many people, so I'm not going to give the kind of depressive answer. So the way to think about it positively is to say, well, Britain has voted to leave the European Union, and the European Union is not Europe. And perhaps the legacy, the cultural legacy, the historical legacy of Europe is greater than that of the European Union, which is one attempt, one institutional instantiation of that model and culture. So I think in taking this forward, where do we go from now? I think it's important to think about this as an attempt, as a way, as an exhortation to reflect critically on the European Union and to make it work, and to sort of believe in the project, but also connect that project with the wider ideal of Europe, which I think is not reducible to the EU institutions. And I think it's very important to think about that when one assesses Brexit or when one thinks about what are these levers up to, how can they not believe in this great project, and to say, well, maybe, you know, perhaps there was a point to their critique, and perhaps we should capitalize on that critique and try and make Europe work in the light of that critique and really deliver on its promise.
Well, you mentioned the B word.
Yes.
David.
Yes, well, I'm probably the same sort of generation as you, and I think I can think of in the days when we used to take the ferry to France, you would drive down to New Haven, and on the way down the hill towards the ferry, it would say, "Welcome to New Haven, gateway to Europe." And I used to remonstrate with my parents about that. But I mean, one of the fundamental, I think the point about the institutions is very important, that actually Europe is not reducible to the EU. And what we're talking about is a range of cultural, philosophical, political value issues which are much larger than a single institution. Britain is odd in many, many ways, and one of them is to do with that particular kind of transatlantic connection, which is not going to go away. We, you know, if you like, there's no way that our history is going to be reducible simply to Europe, but then that would be true of France, it would be true of most of the countries. You know, we're not, it's not an either-or kind of thing. In terms of generational differences, it seems to me, you know, fundamentally important, if I think of my son's generation and so on, they have never lived in a Britain in which the Channel was an impenetrable or you know, the, a real barrier. They live in a Channel generation, where you can get on Eurostar and 2 hours later you are in Paris or in Brussels. And that makes them think about mobility, I think, in a different way. And it has an effect on mentality. It doesn't necessarily mean they embrace everything about France or Belgium, whatever it is. But, you know, you're not thinking about barriers in the way that has been traditional. For the English, let's put it this way, the English have grown up, and of course it's part of our folklore, on the idea that there is a clear border, you can talk about a border, it's the White Cliffs of Dover. And Shakespeare talked about the Channel as the moat defensive. Of course, it's a rather partial view of British history, or English history, because we've never had very clear borders to the north or to the west, with Scotland and with Wales. And I think that part of the lesson of most British people going to the continent is that sense that borders that once existed and are meaningless now. I mean, if you think of driving across Belgium, Netherlands, Germany, you know, that whole area, you can go and you can sort of see these little border posts. And I have found it also very useful sometimes with students to show them some pictures of the border that was once there between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. And it was huge. It was very complex. You know, it was a very security issue. God willing, it will not come back again. But borders are porous, and we need to help people think about the reality of national traditions, but the ways in which there is something larger than that. And I think that's part of the project for the future.
Which, in a sense, brings us back to one of the great Enlightenment images, that of the Republic of Letters, the one which allowed free circulation of ideas and values. So thank you all for taking part. Thank you to our speakers, and good evening to you all.